From cranky teens to wide-awake retirees, the sleep crisis is real. Here's what nobody's telling you.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk about sleep and the science behind sleep. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we are talking with Helene Emsalem. She's a sleep doctor with tremendous numbers of years of experience and very well respected in the community, and she's bringing us some answers. So, Dr. Emsalem, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you here. So, for today's show, I kind of want to have basically three sections that I think we'll talk about. One of them is we're going to talk about teens, because I know there's a lot of questions people have about teens and sleep. Another one would be retirees, because again, we have big life changes when we retire and we're no longer doing that 9-to-5 run into work. And then finally, we can talk a little bit about sleep medications and what they do and what they don't do, because I know that a lot of patients have questions about those. So if you're ready, I'm going to dive in and I'm going to start off and ask you, tell us, what are some of the biggest issues that you have seen with teens and their sleep compared to other patients?
There are huge issues with teens and sleep, as anyone who's living with one knows. Their whole biological rhythm shifts with puberty to a later time set. And we have a pretty much a crisis in this country with school start times early. And kids' brains in a normal average 15 or 16-year-old across the summer, they migrate to going to bed at midnight and sleeping till 9. They need 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep a night to function optimally and be the charming individuals that they're capable of being. And when they've got bus pickups at 6:30 to 7 o'clock in the morning, this creates a huge crisis because you can't just tell your brain, okay, I'm going to go to sleep right now, and have it work that way.
Right. So teens who are up all night, late night, they're not just being, what's the word, obstinate, you know, oh, I want to play my video games and that's more important than my sleep.
Well, I mean, you know, the video games are quite engaging. They require every cell in your brain to fire, and they're just not a great thing to be doing within the hour before bedtime. So great to do that as a wind down after school, but later in the evening, it's just so engaging and gets them so revved up. It can exacerbate the problem. And most teens are not up all night. The problem is if their biological rhythm sits at a bedtime of 11 p.m. and they need 9 hours of sleep a night, there's no way they're going to be able to wake up easily in the morning. And, you know, some are more disciplined and powerful in their ability to hear alarms, but I think there are a lot of teen parents who will tell you that I can hear the alarm across the house and my kid is sound asleep in the bed right next to it. Think about it. They're in stage 4 deep, slow wave sleep like we would be at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. So you know, the reality right now is in most places, based upon the school start times, the teen has to be up early, which means they're only getting a certain number of hours of sleep. If they go to bed at midnight and they got to be up at, you know, 6, let's say, and then that means they're going to school. They haven't had the sleep they need. What's the real impact that sleep or lack of sleep may have on them in school?
Well, I mean, first, to get them out the door, I mean, you wake up a teen after 6 hours of sleep or even 7, and you've got an irritable, grouchy individual on your hands. But then they can't focus. They can't attend. They can't pay attention. The amazing thing is that insufficient sleep makes you look like you have raging ADD. So the inability to focus, attend, concentrate are key symptoms of sleep deprivation and also ADD. Then if you take your kid to the doctor because they can't pay attention and attend and they put them on a stimulant medicine that rolls over and makes them sleep less, you exacerbate the problem rather than fixing it.
Right.
So it's very challenging.
Wow. You know, that is something that is a real challenge, because we see so much discussion about ADD and ADHD today, and we see so many kids on meds for that. And, you know, I find in a lot of the discussions that I have with people that in Europe, for example, compared to the U.S., there tends to be more acknowledgement and inquiry into sleep issues before they jump into something else. In the U.S., have you had any experience? I mean, obviously, you practice sleep medicine, but outside of sleep medicine, have you had experience with patients who maybe the doctors and people they've worked with kind of missed the fact that sleep might have been the issue more so than something else?
Well, I mean, I think I'm practicing in a pretty well-versed and well-read area, and I think doctors do recognize it. They just don't know what else they can do about it. It's a frustrating problem, and, you know, the idea that we could just be better parents and parent more rigidly and get the lights out and have, you know, phone off times, not a bad thing to have, and lights out times. But you can't mandate that your kid's brain shuts down and falls asleep. I mean, that's mandated by the timing of your circadian rhythm and what you've set as a pattern in the week before that particular day. So I think doctors are challenged by this and don't have a lot of easy tools. They don't have a lot of time with patients, the primary care docs. I mean, nor do the sleep docs these days. And getting into what their pattern is and where the problems lie. You get to the end of a school week, and if you're, let's just say your kid went to bed at 11 and got up at 6 and got 7 hours of sleep a night, they are likely 2 hours sleep deprived each day. They hit their weekend in a 10-hour sleep debt. And most parents are like, oh, Lord, let them sleep because I don't want to grouch on my hands today. Right. And you know, you feel for your kid and you want them to get rested. And picking compromises where you let them sleep in up to 2 hours later than the usual school wake-up time, sometimes three. I mean, getting kids up on the weekends before 9 a.m. is pretty much impossible. But don't let them sleep 5 hours and 6 hours. Let them get up, do some things. And I find that the slump time of day, the siesta time of day between 3 and 5 is a great time to park them back down and see if they can take a nap and do split the catch up, do some of the catch up sleep later in the afternoon, which is biologically a little easier to get the sleep done. They push through the whole day and take a nap at 8 p.m., we're in big trouble.
Right, right. Well, that actually, you know, is sort of the question I was thinking of next, which is, so if we're waking them up way before they're ready to get up on a regular school day, we send them to school, we put them through a whole day of school, they come home, is it reasonable that they would be able to just go take a nap and catch up and then everything is fine?
Yeah, you know, you get the kids sort of separate out into two groups on that. There's some kids who can come home, get something to eat, and lie down, and, you know, they'll put the TV on and they will fall asleep. I encourage them to set an alarm for an hour. You start to sleep more than 45 minutes or so, you can get into deep, slow wave sleep and get this phenomenon of sleep drunkenness, and they're sluggish and they feel worse afterwards. But if you can limit that nap and get it in, it really does give them the power to take on their homework and go out and play a little bit and have some fun and do the things they want to do. And then it's far enough away from the bedtime that that dose of sleep doesn't interfere. I mean, there's some studies that show actually that if you take a nap at lunch and have an hour before your math exam, you're going to do better from having had that nap than you would without it. So napping is a powerful skill set if you can get the kids to settle down and do it. You don't want them to be over-programmed where they never have a chance to do that kind of thing.
Right, right.
So, by the way, Andrew, some of the kids just say, I can't wake up from the nap. And then they have to push through and try to get them to get the lights out and settle down at a reasonable time.
Wow, there's so many issues there. So what about this one then? You have a lot of teens, obviously they're in high school, they're trying to do well, they want to get into college, they're concerned about their tests and their grades and all these things. And so you have the very common concept of, oh, well, I pulled an all-nighter, you know, I studied really hard for this test and I made myself stay up and study. What's the reality that teens should be aware of in terms of if they're studying for a test and they have this big test the next day, optimally for their brain to be able to retain the information that they've learned and process the information they have, is it best to stay up and pull an all-nighter?
Oh, Lord, no. Not that I haven't done it myself, and I think we all have, but there's some fabulous studies done by a scientist named Robert Stickel that show that if you learn information on Monday morning at 8 a.m. And you never look at it again, and you get your necessary allocation of sleep on Monday night and Tuesday night, testing on Wednesday, you're going to do better on that material than you did getting tested on it immediately after it was presented. We learn when we sleep. Sleep is critical to processing information, throwing out the riffraff, being able to focus on what's important and getting to the point. And so the moral of that story is you have to pace out your studying. And it was hard for me to do my whole life, and I still wait till the last minute to do projects. But if you can help your child learn to do a little bit each day, then that gives, and they get enough sleep on it. So if you critically sleep restrict them down to 7 hours a night for the 3 days before the exam, they can sit there and study for 2 hours and none of it ever gets in. It's so frustrating.
Right, right. Wow. Well, that's sort of an important lesson that I learned later in life and wish I had known it when I was in high school. So what about, let me just flip this for a second. We're talking about teens, but we've got, you know, most teens at home have parents at home. And how does the teen's sleep impact the parent's sleep, if at all?
Well, you know, good parents want to make sure their kids are up and get some kind of food in them and get to the bus on time. And if you have to wake up with your kids and you can't get anything done till they're settled in bed and you know they're in the right place, many, many parents are sleep deprived during the school year. I see parents and talk to them in the summertime, and they're doing great. Their own insomnia is better. They're better rested. They're able to get up at the time they need to in the morning, but they're getting up at 7:30 or 8. They're not getting up at 6:30, and that hour is critical. And it's always easier biologically to sleep in a little later than it is to get yourself to wind down earlier. So that takes a lot of discipline and consistent behavior.
Wow. Yeah, it's, you know, when you start looking at the big picture, you start to recognize how important the teen sleep is, not just for the teen, but for their learning, for the family, for the parents, for all this stuff. So there's a couple more questions I have for you about teens and some kind of fads that are going around. But before we do that, I want to stop and take a commercial break, and we will be right back on Sleep Science Today with Dr. Helene Emsalem.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Sleep Science Today offers a lot of great resources for our listeners, including a popular sleep support group. Don't miss out on what we have to offer. Find all of our resources at sleepsciencetoday.com. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe to this channel.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Dr. Helene Emsalem. We're talking about teens and sleep. And in a second here, I want to transition over into retirees. But before that, I have a question about a couple things that you see all over the internet these days. One of them is teens and sleeping, or really adults too, who go into bed and they bring their phone with them. And they love to scroll on social media or things like that. And then you see this hack. Oh, well, all I need to do is I just put sunglasses on when I'm looking at my phone, and that blocks the blue light and I'm fine. Truth or fiction?
Well, light is a drug that promotes wakefulness. And it is true that it is the short frequency blue end of the light spectrum that stimulates photopic receptors in the retina that go straight to your hypothalamus and say, it is light out, wake up. And that hypothalamus speaks to your entire brain. So the light is alerting. Regular sunglasses are not spectacular, just making it dark or using the dark settings on your phone, not the whole answer. Most phones have a blue light filter that puts an amber tint on the screen. That will help. But it doesn't block the cognitive engagement of holding something, reading something, using your eyes, processing multiple areas, watching a short video, and then you've got auditory sections of your brain. If you do a glucose utilization study when you're just laying there relaxing and scrolling, your brain's on fire. It's lit up everywhere. This is not a wind down activity. Plug an earbud in and listen to it if you have to. Listening is a much more passive operation. I encourage everybody to set the blue light filter on their phone. Doesn't matter if you've got a Droid or an iPhone. There are settings to set that, and I'd set it to turn on about an hour and a half before your desired sleep onset time and turn off at your earliest wake-up time. And that does help, but it doesn't stop your brain from being active and keeping you from falling asleep.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's just such a big issue. It's such a common thing for people to crawl into bed with the phone in their hand, and then they use it to what they believe is calming themselves down to go to sleep, but they don't recognize all of the things that you just shared. Fact or myth, I'm not going to judge, and I'd love to hear your feedback. We see a lot of talk today about mouth tape. Oh, mouth taping is the panacea to all of your sleep problems. Have you had any experience with patients who use mouth tape?
Really, honestly, Andrew, just in my population of adults with sleep apnea who think they're opening their mouth, it's pretty awful. There are few patients who can actually tolerate it. We have the ability to breathe through our nose or mouth. We're obligate nose breathers. We want to breathe through our nose at night, but not having the mouth available to take a breath in if you need to is uncomfortable for most people. And I don't see the benefit if they're trying to muffle snoring. Snoring is a deep guttural noise, and just closing your mouth isn't really going to take it away. Opening up nasal airflow may do a better job with that. So not a fan.
Great, great. Yeah, it's kind of the consensus of the science studies and sleep experts, yet on the internet, things take on a life of their own. All right. Well, so that's a lot of the good questions I had about teens, and I want to make sure that we switch now and talk about retirees. And, retirement for many people, great time of life. They work so hard. They want to get to a point where they have free time. They can enjoy themselves. They can travel. So there's a lot of positives. But like most sleep doctors that I speak with, and even in my own practice, the patients that I work with, you have people who, two things are happening in retirement. One, they're obviously older And two, their whole schedule has changed because they don't have to be up and go to work anymore. So my first question to you is, what are some of the common issues that you see from retirees and sleep-related issues?
Well, you know, there's a subset of the retirees who are just thrilled to be able to sleep later in the morning. Uh-huh. And when you do that, it is your wake-up time in the morning that sets the timing for when you're going to be awake and when the brain is going to permit you to go to sleep. Uh-huh. So, I mean, the people who had to get up at 6 a.m. to be in the office at 8 are thrilled to sleep till 9. But the problem is you can't sleep till 9 5 days a week and then make it to an 8 a.m. book club. If you decide you want to do it, or if you sleep till 9, you're not going to be at your bridge game at 9 a.m.
Right.
So I do see a subset of retirees who have taken advantage of that lack of demand to get up in the morning, but then come in with a complaint that I can't fall asleep till 1 o'clock in the morning or 2, and I can't do the things I want to do with my friends in the morning. Now, the difference between them and the teens, which is kind of a flashback to what's happening to the teens, the difference is, first, they usually confess about what they're doing, so it's not as much of a discovery mission for me. But also, they're willing to listen. I find that anybody, even an 11-year-old, if you explain how your sleep cycle works, they are more mindful of what the variables are. So I find that when we identify these problems in adults, they can fairly, you know, in a 4 to 6 week period of time, they can move the wake up time back and shift the schedule back and have it work. Mm-hmm. You can wake up any day at 6 a.m. that you decide you want to. But if you try to leap from 9 a.m. back to waking up at 6 a.m., you'll be successful for 2 or 3 days, crash, burn, and sleep till 10, and have to start all over again. So it is a slow process.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We also take advantage of light, remembering that light promotes wakefulness. So, you know, getting up in the morning, three things. Getting light exposure in the morning when you wake up, moving, so getting yourself going. You know, you wake up, roll over and lie in bed for an hour and read the paper. Nice to be able to do that, but you didn't give the whole adrenaline cue to your body that you got to get going. And food digestion is an awake process, so eating a little bit of breakfast, I think, reinforces that wake-up time for people.
Right, right. So, you know, with the ability to have extra time in one schedule when we're not having to go to get up and go to work, I talk with a lot of my own patients who are probably, let's say, 80 years old, give or take. So let's say 70 to 80 and above. And one of the big issues that I hear a lot from them is, you know, I wake up so early. I don't want to have to wake up so early. My whole life, I always slept until, you know, X time. And now I must have this sleep problem because I get up so early and I can't stay asleep. Is that something that you run across? And if so, are there any things that we should be thinking about when those issues arise?
Well, there's early and there's early, right? So, I mean, if they wish they could sleep till 9 every day and they're going to bed at midnight and they're waking up at 7, that makes sense, and I don't see that as early. For the people, and it's not always in the elderly population and throughout the adult population, who go to sleep and wake up at 3 a.m. and feel like they are crystal clear and wide awake at 3 a.m. And that is extremely problematic. And this is another time when it's better to plug in and listen to something. My general guidance is to look at what's going on. Stressors can clearly trigger those early morning awakenings that are premature, and having them take the time during the day to address the issues that are at hand in their lives is very important. Actual depression may need to be treated when it presents that way. But there are other people who don't have a beautiful, easily identifiable cause. And there, I encourage people not to argue with your bladder as an adult when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Just go and try not to light up every light on the way. Red night lights in the bathroom are much better than blue ones, which are alerting. And get back in bed. And I have people plug in and listen as a distractor. I mean, I think there are people who can do the mindfulness exercises, wiggle your left toe, wiggle your right toe. For me, when I'm up at that hour, I'm pretty well wired and my mind's ready to write a paper and worry about the grandkids or something. And so I find that a lot of people need a distractor to override. And I have sort of a hierarchy that I recommend of music. If you're not a musician and you're not going to dissect the chord structure, and you enjoy it. My only criterion with the music, I mean, I really don't care if my patients listen to Gregorian chants or hard rock. It's just that it not be loud and not have a reverberating bass as an alerting factor. But music, podcast, and then TED Talks. And the art form of finding a 10 to 15 minute TED Talk on a topic that's interesting enough for you to start to listen to it at that hour, but not so interesting that it would be tragic if you fell asleep while you're listening to it. And I have people keep a comfortable headset or a pillow speaker. I think of the sound as being inside you at night like that and pushing your thoughts out of the way and buffering you from outside noises in the house as well and letting your brain just wind back down again. So it's an art form to recover from those.
Mm-hmm. So someone who is, let's say, I don't know, maybe 75 years old, they retired at 60 something, they have gotten into a pattern now where they don't have a whole lot of stuff that they're doing during the week. They're spending more time at home. And then they end up realizing that, you know, I'm waking up at about 4:30 every morning. And no matter what I try and do, I can't stay asleep. Is there something wrong there, or is that something that is not unexpected in some cases?
I'm not sure that it's a normal part of aging. I think there are factors that can trigger that, and there are things we do that perpetuate it. I mean, if you get angry and you just say, I'm never going to sleep, and you start to go down that slippery slope of negative thinking about what's happening to you, you're actually aggravating the awakening. And dealing with this, with that kind of negative thinking is important, cognitive reframing and thinking through what's happening and giving yourself a distractor. But getting up and going to the kitchen and opening the refrigerator with a bright glass of light and eating something and then sitting down and doing a crossword puzzle in the living room are all, part of things that get recommended at times. But in the middle of the night, I find that they're just physically and cognitively activating. And so I really do encourage people to find an array of things to listen to and to try to stay. I talk about staying in bed, in the dark, in a sleep conducive position, because once you're up and on go, you're not going to fall back to sleep. And then there are, Andrew, other factors. Obstructive sleep apnea is a problem with intermittent episodes of stoppage of airflow at night. It occurs more from mid-age. It usually onset in the 50s and 40s to 60s, perhaps as a peak, but then carries on. And we're paralyzed in REM sleep. Most of the last third of our night is REM sleep, and REM-related apneas sometimes can wake patients at that hour. So there's a point in time when you're not winning with managing this with, straightforward logical behaviors that getting in and seeing your doctor, asking whether there are concerns about apnea. Everybody with apnea doesn't snore. Women think that it's a men's disease, but it's not. And particularly postmenopausal women have a rate of apnea that just comes right up and matches that of men. And there are some women who are loud, disruptive snorers and have prototypical symptoms of apnea, but there are also women who just wake up tired and can't sleep. So having pushing your doc to think about it with you is important.
Yeah, no, I love that last point because, you know, typically just because of news media and whatever, people think apnea, oh, that means you must be an overweight, you know, male around 60 years old, so on and so forth. And that's not necessarily true about all sleep apnea. So, you know, women, postmenopausal women, as you were saying, who aren't necessarily carrying extra weight or meeting any of these other things, they too can be affected by sleep apnea.
You know, and it's important to remember that, you know, weight is not the only factor in whether or not you're at risk for apnea. Mm-hmm. So chin and jaw structure can be important. All of our airways are different sizes and shapes and have different resilience to closure. So I have long, skinny people with apnea and heavy people with apnea. And losing weight sometimes helps, doesn't always.
Right, right.
Because of the other variables. Yeah.
Exactly. So basically the point is the things you hear on the internet, you may want to look a little bit deeper into the actual science behind things as opposed to somebody's opinion. Because everybody on the internet has an opinion. Not too many of them based on science. Well, this is a perfect spot to stop for our next commercial break. So we're going to take a break and we will be right back with Dr. Helene Emsalem.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sleep Science Today offers a lot of great resources for our listeners, including a popular sleep support group. Don't miss out on what we have to offer. Find all of our resources at sleepsciencetoday.com. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe to this channel.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
Okay, we are back on Sleep Science Today, and we were just talking about sleep issues for retirees. Now, if it's okay, I'd love to switch over and start talking about some of the issues related to sleep medicines. And I have a lot of different questions here, but nobody better to ask than a sleep doctor. Sleep meds, can you give us just sort of a basic rundown in terms of what are sleep medications? Is there such thing as a pill that will make you get restful sleep? Give us the framework here.
Interesting way you worded the question, Andrew. Is there a pill that will help you get restful sleep? Right. So the sleep medications that are on the market are generally designed to help you fall asleep or stay asleep. They are not really addressing sleep quality. In the choice of a medication, when you go that route, and I want to tell you a little bit about that, but in the choice of a medication, you do want a medication that is not going to interfere with the normal cycling through the stages of sleep and the amount of time that you get in REM sleep and deep sleep, each of which are critical to waking up feeling rested in the morning. I'll just stop.
So, yeah, and I know this is it's a really difficult area because, you know, for me, I always remember I went into the drugstore one day, and I was in line waiting for the pharmacy to pick up a prescription. And there was a woman in front of me, and she was really, really stressed out because, and she was sharing with everybody in line why she was stressed out. And the reason she was stressed out is because for years and years and years and years, she had been taking her sleep medicine, and there's no way that she can sleep without it. And they were out of the sleep medicine, and she was out of sleep medicine. So she was completely convinced that she absolutely was never going to sleep again until she got another one of these pills. And, you know, we talk about the difference between how the psychological factors affect sleep, the behavioral factors affect sleep, and then the medications. And that's kind of what raises a lot of these questions in my mind is I because I do the behavioral side of sleep medicine, not the medical side like you do, I see a lot of people who have convinced themselves they've got to take this pill or they're never going to sleep again. And then we talk about, you know, are you actually getting restful sleep? Are you getting stage three sleep? Or are you getting knocked out and you think you're sleeping, but you're really tired because you've never slept? And are these pills made for the long term, the short term? Those are the types of questions that come up. So I wonder if there's anything in there that you have some feedback on for us that could help us understand that better.
I think there's some really important points around that. And that is that even though I'm the medical doctor with the power to prescribe these drugs, the data for the management of sleep onset insomnia, which can affect, you know, a good solid 15% of the population chronically, not to mention we've all experienced it acutely, but the data on sleep onset difficulties shows that in the long run, people do better, reach a better endpoint and hold that endpoint longer with cognitive behavioral therapy to manage the insomnia rather than the use of drugs. And in my practice, I end up seeing patients who are frustrated for a long time and have had some introduction to what's called CBT for insomnia. And I may choose on a temporary basis to use a combination of something to help them be successful. But addressing the behavioral factors is absolutely critical. What we do as humans on this planet, when we get in bed for two nights in a row and we can't sleep, is we start getting in bed earlier and earlier and earlier. And we make the period of time that we have to try to sleep not only longer, but too long for you to biologically be able to do. And then that also gives you a lot of time to be in there thinking, you know, at some point you're going to start down that slippery slope of, oh my goodness, I'm not falling asleep. My day is going to be ruined tomorrow. And all the negative thinking components, which is the cognitive part of cognitive behavioral therapy. So for people who have difficulty with sleep onset, the guidance I give them is, let's take a careful look at where your wake-up time is, always thinking that about the fact that it's your wake-up time that is going to be the guidepost for when you're going to be able to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And the normal adult sleep requirement is 7 to 9 hours. I see a lot of 7 to 8, 8.5 hours. I don't see a lot of 9-hour sleepers. They're either not there or they're very happy. I'm not sure which. but if you're a 7-hour sleeper and you're having trouble initiating sleep, then we look pretty carefully at what time are you actually falling asleep. And then keeping people busy out of bed, but with wind down activities, settling their brains down and not letting them get in bed till much closer to the time that they're actually falling asleep. We do have a very real issue of our bed and our bedroom programming us to have subliminal responses, just like Pavlov and the dog. Pavlov rang a bell and brought the dog food and linked the bell to the food, and the dog learned to salivate to the bell. I mean, that makes no sense biologically, right?
Right.
So, you know, we can become allergic to the bedroom. And, you know, sometimes I'll have people shift the head to the foot of the bed, but staying out of there until it's time to go to sleep is important. And settling, you know, we we're a society on go. You know, we live in a 24/7 lit world. We're exposed to light. Cave people had dusk and darkness. And we actually evolved as the human species. Sometimes I think about, why did humans win the battle of the species of the day back in the time? We keep finding different skulls. Well, we became synchronized to the day-night cycle. Those photopic receptors in the retina see dusk and they shut down the pineal gland and the secretion of melatonin. So we're supposed to fall asleep on a rising melatonin level. And we start to wake up as that melatonin level about 2 hours before the wake-up time peaks and starts to drop again. Mm-hmm. And the dimming of ambient light is a big cue to that, as well as the last whole week at 10 o'clock, she started to chill out before she got in bed at 11. So all of those things become important factors, and you really need to talk to the person and have them think about what they're doing and where the schedule is and how they're managing it. And that's critically important well before drugs come into the picture.
Right. Well, it's, we're basically out of time here, but I do want to ask one last question because I don't want to leave without asking. You know, you talked about melatonin, and I know a lot of people can go into the drugstore and they purchase melatonin gummies, and to some people, it's the panacea that's going to, you know, make me sleep great. The short answer, can you tell us, melatonin, is it good to rely upon getting a 10 milligram melatonin gummy and using it and thinking it's going to knock yourself out, or what does it really do?
Well, I mean, for a lot of people, not much. I mean, it doesn't get into the brain well when we eat it or swallow it or chew it as a gummy. And there are different melatonin receptors. So melatonin is involved in the transition to sleep. And my approach to this is, and there's also, you know, melatonin is not a regulated compound. And when you take your 10 milligram melatonin pill, it might have 1 milligram or 30 milligrams of melatonin in it. So quality control in the melatonin world is something that the sleep community is concerned about. But generally, if I get cornered at a cocktail party or I'm out somewhere and they find out I'm a sleep doctor, and the question is, you know, I take my 3 milligrams of melatonin every night and I sleep like a baby, I say, great, keep doing it. Because it's really not going to do any harm at that dose. It has been tested in doses up to 60 milligrams. Some people get vivid nightmares, but there are very few contraindications to it. But there's no difference in the literature between taking 3 milligrams and 10 milligrams. And, you know, most people find that it either helps them or it doesn't, and they stop it. But more and more and more, not a good plan. It's not going to get you anywhere.
Right. Perfect. Well, we are even a little bit over time here. So I want to thank you, Dr. Amsalem, for taking the time to share your experience and knowledge with us. These are common questions that I know so many people have, and now they have heard from an expert and they've gotten more information that they can use. So thank you for being on the show, and we'd love to have you back at a future date, because there's so many issues about sleep that we can't cover it all in just one show.
Thank you.
So you all have been listening to Sleep Science Today. I encourage you to visit us on our website at sleepsciencetoday.com, where you will find access to all sorts of free materials. One of the big things we have is a free sleep support group. So if you have trouble with your sleep and you want to hear from others and share with others and learn a little bit, it's a great place to be. So all this you can find on sleepsciencetoday.com, and we'll see you on our next show.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.